Hello there, everybody. It's Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Sorry for the delay, as we calmly get ourselves through all kinds of things. But luckily, our serotonin is in place, and if we have our serotonin in place, it makes things a lot easier.
Absolutely. Mellows us out with little snafus in life.
That's the voice of the mellifluous, Kent Robertshaw.
Nice to be here, folks.
And Stephanie Dahmer is with us as well today. We're going to need her in here because we have to talk about some issues related to serotonin or serotonin.
Hello,
as
everyone.
I've heard it pronounced. I've heard the Indian pronunciation, serotonin. I like that, you know, as in seraglio, serotonin. Serotonin, it's a very interesting thing. We talk about that a great deal, but some recent research has appeared talking about Libby Zion. Now, Kent, you were around for Libby Zion, weren't you?
Yeah, Libby Zion was a famous case that happened at New York Hospital in 1984.
And your Ken Robertshaw, by the way, is a physician, and he was at New York Hospital around that time, and it was a form of drug poisoning which nobody understood until they later diagnosed it as what?
As a serotonergic syndrome or overdose of serotonin in her system because of the medication that she was given at the time.
So there we are, my friend, serotonin. We like serotonin. Serotonin makes you feel good, right? Now, during a woman's cycle, we'll talk about women specifically, serotonin shifts. Stephanie, what happens to serotonin during different part times of the cycle?
It's related to the estrogen. So for the first 14 or 15 days of a woman's menstrual cycle, serotonin is at a higher level because the estrogen is high. Estrogen and serotonin work hand in hand. Estrogen allows the serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, to pass from one neuron to the next. So if there's not enough estrogen during the second half of the cycle, the serotonin can drop. And that's one of the experiences that women feel, that irritability. The estrogen drops and the serotonin drops. So that is one of the connections. Estrogen basks the synapses, those two parts of the neuron that are connected with the traveling axon, I think
mm-hmm.
it's
axon.
What it is. Okay. And that's the relationship. Estrogen is needed for the serotonin to work as effectively as it can.
Men and women both need serotonin.
And men even have estrogen, too.
Yeah, but the difference between men and women is that men don't lose their serotonin as quickly.
Probably because of the estrogen. That's a
what
theory.
What do you mean because of?
Well, maybe they don't have that drop the way that women do in their cycle. So maybe they aren't.
So therefore their serotonin is available and replenished easily, and it's there more often. So women seem to be more sensitive to the loss of serotonin and the uptake of serotonin. Now let's talk about this amazing discovery they made. If people have low serotonin, what happens to them, Kent?
Well, low serotonin, as Stephanie was talking about, which happens during PMS part of the cycle, but also happens to a lot of people when a syndrome of depression comes on them or times of the winter. Many people are coming out of the winter blues, and we understand that that's also a time where this brain chemical that is essential for one nerve to talk to another, they use this chemical serotonin, that it gets too low. And when it's too low in a person, they start to have a whole cluster of symptoms that look very common. Depression being one of the first symptoms. Anxiety would be another symptom. Certainly craving carbohydrates and sweets. Some of you may notice that in the winter time, as well as PMS, that they look very similar, that you feel like sleeping sleeping all the time, you're a little cranky, you crave sweets, and it's not uncommon, or it's not a coincidence, because it's thought that both the PMS syndrome as well as the seasonal affective disorder, which we call the winter blues, are both because there's too little serotonin in the brain for one brain cell to talk to another, and it causes these kind of cluster of symptoms that are very uncomfortable for people when their serotonin's too low.
Now, could it be that the depression causes the drop in serotonin? Because we know the drop in serotonin will lead itself or lend itself towards a depressive syndrome, but I've also seen people with low serotonin not get depressed. So there seems to be something, you know, there are some people are much more susceptible to it premenstrually than are others. So is it that, you know, you could have a real drop in serotonin and not get depressed, but is it that the depression and anxiety can cause a drop in serotonin, or do you think it's only the other way around, the serotonin causes the depression?
Well, again, it really shows the rich interaction between the brain and the mind, and the answer is yes. Does depression cause decreased serotonin? Can decreased serotonin cause depression? The answer is yes. It's a moot point to kind of tease out chicken and egg. The reality is the mind is very powerful, and if psychological or situations happen in people's lives, it can cause the brain to produce less serotonin and produce a syndrome. And laboratory studies would show that with animals, including human beings, you can artificially and, you know, lower people's serotonin, and most people actually become depressed if you artificially lower their serotonin. So the answer is depression can cause low serotonin. Low serotonin can cause depression. It feeds into itself in a very negative cycle.
Well, yeah, except for one reason, Kent, that it would make a difference. Because we found that if you have somebody who's depressed and you do some kind of dynamic, effective psychotherapy that works at reversing the depression through using body-mind kind of experiences like, you know, yelling, shouting, getting active, using their autonomic nervous system in a more aggressive way, their sympathetic nervous system, you could lift their depression. Now, when doing that, as you actually lift the depression, you can actually shift the serotonin as well. So there is one way to do it, which is to do it through psychotherapeutic means. Another way to do it, if you believe that the cause is the serotonin, is, of course, to medically or organically or even naturally go after the serotonin itself. There are two different approaches.
Absolutely.
But we know that you could work from both sides with depression and with low serotonin. Now, here comes the real interesting information, and this is the information that came out of the New York Times today, which is what put this all together, which is they discovered that high serotonin is a danger. Yes. Now, you know, if you walk around and you say, what would you like for Christmas? And somebody said, how about a bottle of serotonin? Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea to have a bottle of serotonin that you could take in your bad days. You know what I mean? Give me a little serotonin, I'll have a drink of serotonin. Hey, can I have a serotonin on the rocks? Not a very bad idea. Because sometimes if it were that easy to up your serotonin, it would be a wonderful thing. What people do instead is they take chemicals to try to do the very same thing. They take specific drugs that are designed to lift up the serotonin levels.
Yeah, absolutely. That many of the antidepressants that we prescribe, or someone like myself prescribes, is really going at the low serotonin directly in terms of artificially causing an increase in the serotonin by, you know, raising the amount of serotonin that the cell sees. And for many people, that can be very helpful to temporarily, you know, cause the serotonin levels to raise, and then people feel less anxious, less depressed, and less irritable.
Dr. Kent Rabashaw, Stephanie Dombra, Armand DeMille, we're talking to you about serotonin now, and later we're going to talk to you about people who get angry spontaneously, explosively. We're going to go there as well. We're with you at The Positive Mind. We're talking about serotonin syndrome. Very, very important. Let's talk about increased serotonin. You get too much serotonin. Your serotonin is high. Let's say it's not low, and then suddenly you're taking one of these medications, these SSRIs, as they're called, mm-hmm. And then you have pain, you break a leg, and somebody gives you, or you have a migraine, and somebody gives you a drug for your migraine, they give you what's called a triptan, sumatriptan, which has been known to treat migraines nowadays, does have an incredible thing. It raises serotonin. Oops. Now, in order to cover the pain part of it, even though this may get rid of it, they give you Demerol or some other painkiller on top of it, and now it further raises the serotonin. Now what happens to you? You start feeling confused. You could have a tremor. You could have diarrhea. You have high blood pressure, anxiety, agitation. You don't know what's going on with you. Your blood pressure is up, and you have this syndrome that is too much serotonin, from which you could die. And I tell you something, having seen a lot of research, even though it is known that when you give somebody an SSRI, when you give somebody Prozac or one of those drugs, if they have migraines, which they frequently do, the two often go together. The people who have that kind of depression often get migraines. You do not think to yourself as a physician, I better not give them a triptan. I better not give them an anti-migraine drug because the both will raise their serotonin. I better not give them a painkiller called Demerol. Well, according to the article by Jane Brody today in Personal Health in the New York Times, that combination is deadly. Deadly. And that it has to be in the physician's caution to pay more attention to what's called serotonin syndrome as a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, again, the article talks about this case that happened in 1984 in New York Hospital. A young woman goes into the emergency room taking an older kind of antidepressant that I'm sure a lot of you have read on the labels of things, MAOI, monooxamine inhibitor, that we don't use that much anymore, but it's a class of antidepressants that she was taking. And on this antidepressant, they gave her Demerol, and the combination of the Demerol with this old kind of antidepressant, which raises serotonin, is thought the combination was deadly and killed her with an extreme form of the serotonergic syndrome of too much serotonin. I think this article and what we're talking about today is many of you out there may be on these meds and not realize that these medications are both, more than one medication you're on, are both affecting the serotonin, maybe coming from two different doctors, because maybe your one doctor is a psychiatrist giving you a Prozac and your GP or your neurologist is giving you something for the triptan for the migraines, or another doctor is, your orthopedic doctor is giving you a narcotic for pain, and they don't really are coordinated, and it's good for you to educate yourself to understand that these medications can work in combination to raise serotonin. And even though before it's like Papa Bear, Mama Bear, too little serotonin we just talked about can make you cranky, irritable, and depressed, and craving carbohydrates, too much serotonin, often only due to excessive medication of two different or three different kinds of medications or an overdose, can cause the kind of symptoms that Armand was talking about jittery, perspiration, rapid heart rate, muscle spasms, diarrhea.
And death. Death is one of the signals that you're taking the wrong medication.
Yeah.
Listen, this is Armand DeMille. The other things that we also get is dietary supplements can do the same thing. Tryptophan, of course, you know, we're taking tryptophan. St. John's wort, a dangerous drug. Not thought about as a dangerous drug. Oh, it's kind of benign. It'll help me with my depression. You take St. John's wort while you're taking some other chemicals in that combination. Ginseng is another one that could raise your serotonin. And then another one that people don't consider very much is the use of ecstasy, a popular drug, a street drug. Ecstasy, if you're, you know, a lot of depressed people like to dance, and they like to get out there and they party. So they're taking SSRIs, they're taking their Prozac, and then they take ecstasy. Now, the combination could be deadly. Could be deadly in the serotonin sense, and Stephanie, it would be deadly at certain times and not at other times, right?
Correct. especially if it's a woman, in her menstrual cycle during the first 15 days when the serotonin level is at the highest, with the estrogen level being the highest.
First 15 days of the month?
Of the menstrual cycle.
Of the menstrual month.
Menstrual month, mm-hmm. Yes.
So it may be at times that you get away with it. At other times, you may just feel funny symptoms. But we are saying, pay attention, friends. Pay attention more than you've ever paid attention, because drugs, chemicals, nutrients, all of the stuff that we have, sulfur, whatever it is, everything we hear Majid Ali say, everything about the supplements are wonderful. But pay attention. It's chemistry. It's still chemistry. If you're breathing oxygen during the day, it's still chemistry. If you soak your feet in peroxide, it's still chemistry. It's all chemistry in one form or another, and give a consideration to what you're doing when you do this chemistry. That's all. Chemistry affects us much more than even psychological factors. And, in fact, can very often create the psychological factors. And this is what we're learning. So confusion, disorientation, agitation, irritability, unresponsiveness, anxiety. And you say to yourself, when you go see doctors nowadays, a real responsible physician asks you, tell me all the supplements you are taking. They don't say, just tell me the drugs you're taking. You know, do you ask that all?
Oh, absolutely. I think, I saw a PBS Frontline about this a few weeks ago, that the number of people who take supplements from GNC or stores like that is absolutely incredible. And most physicians don't ask the question about supplements. They don't even think about it, even though in our society an enormous amount of people are taking supplements. It's a huge industry. And I think that the idea that some of these supplements, just because you don't need a prescription and you can go into a health food store, you may get the idea that it's benign as, you know, apples and oranges that you can go into the supermarket. And this kind of understanding that these have a lot of interactions with other supplements. So if you're on ginseng and St. John's wort and you're taking, you know, let's say, a cold medication, a very important medication that we haven't talked about yet, that also causes this serotonin syndrome, that all these things over the counter or in a health food store together could cause some serious over-serotonin and the kind of problems we're talking about.
You know, how would somebody, though, get to really understand and what the chemistry is doing to them? How would they really? Because, you know, it's not just the physician doesn't understand. The pharmacist doesn't really understand. The company is not going to tell you about it. I mean, things as dangerous as grapefruit juice can be dangerous, right, with certain chemicals. You know, chocolate and cheese, I remember, you shouldn't take with MAO inhibitors. You know what I used to think MAO inhibitors were? I thought it was a Chinese political party, mm-hmm, the Mao, mm-hmm, inhibitors. But, you know, you can't – how do you get to understand it? And I think the way you get to understand it is you do everything slowly and you watch yourself. And you don't allow yourself to just toss off any reaction. You say, ah, and you take your blood pressure. You get a little blood pressure machine. Take your blood pressure. Keep your pulse. Keep it active. See what these things do to you within a day. Stephanie?
I wanted to give an example of this very thing we're talking about. One other supplement that I think is also important to name is melatonin. And I have a certain client that is probably at the beginning of the syndrome that you're talking about, the serotonin syndrome. Mm-hmm. It's the overdose. Mm-hmm. She's taking melatonin. She's taking nortriptyline, which is the precursor to serotonin production. Mm-hmm. And she's on a lot of Zoloft. Mm-hmm. And she is profusely sweating. So I said, you need to go and get your blood level checked. And that was one thing I wanted to ask you, Kent. Can you get your serotonin levels checked?
No.
No,
you cannot.
They say you can through sweat Or through,
if they stick a needle in your back, maybe, meaning I think the cerebral spinal fluid is a way.
The only place.
The only place. It's something that, again, right now it's predominantly a clinical diagnosis to sort of see these cluster of symptoms we're talking about. And for those of you listening, yes, if you're on a combination of different medications, certainly melatonin, but a key one, tryptophan, which you can get in health food stores. Again, tryptophan, particularly combined with serotonergic agents like Zoloft or the powerful serotonergic agents that are used to treat migraines like Imitrex, tryptophan over the counter plus any of these agents are very, very dangerous because you're giving the chemical that turns into serotonin as well as something that boosts the serotonin. And so there's lots of literature that combination in particular can be very, very lead to this serotonergic syndrome.
And therefore your symptoms would be, but the thing is to watch your symptoms. Your heart's beating fast, you're starting to sweat, you're beginning, hold on a second. Don't keep doing what you're doing if you're having a bad reaction. Just if you're having a reaction, slow everything down. Let's find out what's going on for you. This is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shaw and Stephanie Dombra. We're talking about the serotonin syndrome, and to remember that if at one particular time you seem to have no reaction, it doesn't mean anything because at another time you could have a reaction. You could have low serotonin one day and high serotonin the next day. As Stephanie Dombra says, if it's the beginning of your cycle, the first 15 days, you're more likely to have a serotonic syndrome than if it's premenstrual time in the last 15 days. The other thing about it that I think is really fascinating is that we have this ability to see ourselves and understand ourselves, but we get blindsided by things that we assume, like taking an antacid can throw an entire balance off of everything we're doing, and we think it's a nothing. And a good one is antibiotics. Antibiotics is another one that increases serotonin. And there are certain antibiotics. Let me see, which one was it today? Do you know which one it is, Kent, or is it just a group? Oh, Zyvox. Mm-hmm. Zyvox, anti-nausea drugs, which is, people take Tums and things like that. Anti-Parkinson drugs. Meridia, the weight loss drug, will increase it.
Well, we're talking about Meridia, by the way. That famous Fen-Phen that we had 10 years ago, the Fen-Phen, which was two different forms of weight loss pills, phentermine and another form of Meridia, that combination was thought to cause cardiac problems but also caused a lot of disruption in people's lives because both of those also increased serotonin, and maybe that was causing a toxicity, at least emotionally and cognitively, with people with Fen-Phen, the famous diet combination 10, 15 years ago, which again goes to the heart of this, which is two medications individually are perhaps safe, but combining the two, like Fen-Phen, but how many other things in 2007 where you're on an antidepressant or a tryptophan, or we haven't even talked about the class of medications, the strong major tranquilizers like Zyprexa and Risperidol, those often given with serotonergic agents like Zoloft and Paxil, they have an increase of serotonin. So how many people are on an antipsychotic or major tranquilizer in the category of Risperidol or Seroquel with an antidepressant who, again, are starting to get a little bit more agitated and irritable and anxious, which is the serotonergic syndrome, and the doctor may think, oh, well, they need more of these meds. Where, in fact, it's a serotonergic syndrome going on, they actually need less. So any of you who know people on those two big categories of medications, think about whether they're being over-medicated and treated for their serotonergic syndrome when, in fact, they need less, not more medication.
Listen, it seems clear that all of us are over-medicated. You know what I mean? It seems clear that the way we're all going is in the direction that's away from that. But the trouble is we don't consider that supplements are also medication. It's like, yes, if we could only go back to eating grass, it would be great. You know, if we could just, you know, I'm a natural diet, I eat clouds and rocks and stuff like that, would be just delicious and just some fresh water. But it's a little more difficult nowadays. You've got to protect yourself from the foods that are grown. This is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shaw. We are talking about the mind, the human mind, and what affects the human mind. Speaking about the human mind, we are going to be seeing a bunch of you soon. And just want to mention a few names to Evelyn and Edward and Marcia and Dorothy and Rose and Kathy and Frank, Angela, Genoveva, Sandra and Maria and Gino, and Sean, and a bunch of others who I will be seeing on Thursday night. Thursday night, we are doing that. They just moved the theater, by the way. HomeTheMovie.com, if you look it up, HomeTheMovie.com. We're going to be showing that film at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where an internal group of WBAI people got together and bought tickets during our fund drive. Well, we had such an overwhelming response that the theater decided to move to a larger theater, which means there's room for more of you. And that group of you could only get the tickets by calling the Brooklyn Academy of Music now. But if you want to join it, I promise you, at the end of the film, I am going to get up on stage and I'm going to take you through something, my friends, that you are going to get moved by. So you get a chance to see me leading you through 10 or 20 minutes of a very dynamic experience, and I am certainly looking forward to seeing Colleen and Leslie and Rena and Ivanhoe and all these Mary Lou and Jim, of course, and Boriana and Felicia. I'm just looking at the names, and so I want to do that. I also want to make mention that in this piece of music that I play following our break, I want to dedicate it to a special person who's passing through life now, Luciana. Lucien Dambra has got a moment, and, well, Lucien's passing through. He's on the last few moments of his life, and I would like all of us to wish him wings. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be back with you. Thank you. Fusion Dumber. And it's Johnny Griffin, Jonas Change of Place album, Soft and Furry. Of course. This is Armand DeMille with you, with Kent Robert Shaw, Stephanie Dumber with In the Positive Mind. We are talking about things related to mood and mood disorders. Tomorrow, a very interesting program. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking about the thermal wars. Oh, you don't know about the thermal wars. The thermal wars are a big thing. Heat-seeking missiles that are in people's bodies. Different people have different temperatures in their bodies, and especially at different times of life. And why do people have different temperatures? Well, Roberta Atti and I are going to be looking at this. I'm going to be looking about how it affects you psychologically, and then what happens when couples get together and start fighting about the temperature, which they do, and what happens. It's kind of an amazing thing. We call it the thermal wars. And this for Neil Schachter, who is very much paying attention to this. You know Dr. Neil Schachter.
Sure.
You met him, right?
Absolutely.
Up at Mount Sinai. So in the studio with us, Ken, and also so that's Wednesday. Thursday, Annalisa Erba is going to be here. And she's talking about some new paradigms for relationships, which should be very, very interesting. And then Thursday night, of course, don't forget, my friends, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. As many of you can get there who want to be there, you call them up and say, are there any tickets left to home? And then you'll be in with the gang. You'll see at least 100 people from WBAI, probably 200, and it should be a happening.
Do people know that you're in the film?
I'm in the film, yes. I don't know if I told people.
I want to remind people that Armand is wonderful in the film.
And so is Woody Allen, and so is Pete Hamill, and Elaine Kaufman, and Fran Lebowitz, and Frank McCourt, Malachi McCourt, Alfred Molina. It's kind of an interesting documentary about New York. It's a happening. It's a good thing. 212. Oh, no, we're not going to take any calls right now. We're going to talk about violence. I want to talk about... You know, you talk about serotonin, then you talk about somebody beating you up. Some people think that the reason that people get violent is because of low serotonin. They think about that, you know, they think about that as being one form of violence, but there's another new face of violence. And this is called the intermittent explosive disorder, which is now being recognized more and more as a diagnostic category. Kent, could you tell us about it?
Yeah, I think that when people think about anger and violence, they think about people who are sort of chronically irritable or kind of like, you know, kind of criminal people like Tony Soprano, you know, who's, you know, angry and kind of aggressive all the time. And we now know that there's a syndrome called the intermittent explosive disorder where people seem to be functioning fairly well and they have sort of out of the blue or with light provocation a sort of out of control angry episode where they just blow their casket, see red, and they are in a rage. They're not even angry anymore. They're in a complete and utter rage. And there's not enough attention given this, certainly by therapists and psychiatrists, in terms of probing people about this kind of episodic, sort of explosive, angry episodes, which obviously cause a great deal of problem with people's interpersonal lives or breaking remote controls and all sorts of damage done to people's, you know, belongings as well as the interpersonal relationships.
Well, no, I mean, is it scary? I mean, it could get really scary. What if you watch somebody you know, Kent, who's slowly getting more and more aggressive?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's certainly for children and spouses, particularly female, you know, wives, being around somebody who is then escalating in out-of-control anger, it can be very frightening for the people around the person to experience something like this, you know, with the idea that they may lose control and become violent and hurt somebody during one of these episodes. And, of course, people do, in fact, get into fights and strike out physically when they have these intermittent explosive episodes.
Well, what's it like? What's it like on the inside to be exploding? This is a real question. What does it feel like? What do you imagine? Do you, who are listening, imagine that somebody who has an intermittent explosive disorder gets angry. Is it a form of anger? Maybe it's not even angry, Kent. Is it, or is it so quick that they just explode? Is it like a dog who barks and bites automatically, or is it like a person who has a growing, seething anger?
Yeah, I think that these people are people that, again, studies would show they're often unaware and can be calm and be sort of easygoing hours beforehand. So, again, it's not necessarily a part of a full-blown kind of irritability syndrome. Again, if we talk diagnostically a little bit later about distinguishing this intermittent explosive disorder from something like hypomania, a topic we've talked about a bit before, where people wake up and throughout the whole day they're kind of irritable all day long. Now, these people are calm, they're sort of easygoing, they're feeling cool on the inside, they're quite calm, and it's almost like an epileptic seizure, as it were, or fainting attack, that it really just overwhelms people, and they feel then overwhelmed with this feeling, and they describe it, the patients I've treated, as, again, like seeing red. They're really almost dissociated. They're almost disconnected to their body.
Well, so dissociated is one of the words, meaning that for the moment you're sitting there and then you feel like you're possessed by the devil. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what dissociated is. You don't feel like it's you anymore. You feel like it's somebody else, and you don't know what it is. And in fact, when you're angry and you're raging very often, you're so possessed that you wish you could stop, but you can't because the other guy is yelling. And because the other guy is yelling and screaming, meaning you, but he's another guy, and because he's yelling and screaming, you can't interrupt him. So now you don't know what to do. There's a consciousness you have about the violence that you're committing, but you're disconnected from the violence that you're committing. Now, women have this as well as men. You know, I mean, it's something that you both go through. I'm sure you've seen yourself screaming and raging and yelling. It's sometimes associated to low serotonin with a premenstrual syndrome, where women will suddenly feel themselves screaming and yelling over nothing, you know, over a minor incident. And they will have this happening, but men have this as well. And you're literally beside yourself. And I love that expression, I am besides myself. It's like I am standing next to myself. And it is my other self that is doing all this stuff. And I don't know how to stop him. I just don't know how to stop him, and I wish I could. And sometimes a hug works. Mostly it doesn't. What we know doesn't work is battle. War doesn't work. Taking me on full face, yelling back at me does not work. That doesn't work. It just helps me explode even more. It just builds the case.
Yeah, it's a time that, again, often people then will quickly, as these episodes subside, these are the cases you'll hear people being very apologetic afterward. They'll have a tremendous sense of remorse, as Armand, you were talking. They even know in the midst of it that they're blowing up over something quite minor, yet they seem to not be able to control themselves. They can't help how enraged they're feeling, as if there's a volcano that has gone off inside them, and they need a release. They need to yell. They need to punch. They need to, express a great deal of anger and rage that's inside. And then, you know, with some clarity, not being beside themselves, but more being connected to who they are and their life experience later on, these are the people that are often very apologetic to coworkers or parents, who will then go to their children and try to apologize for some episode that they know was not really quite out of control and frightening and quite damaging to the relationship.
It's very much like steroidal, you know, there's a thing called roid rage, which is a very interesting expression for people who take steroids. Some people, when they have certain disorders, they're given steroids by their physicians. And the steroids kind of build up the same kind of thing. You have this kind of explosive button. And then what happens is you suddenly find out you're exploding over nothing. Now the trouble is, the apology afterwards, it would seem to work, but it usually doesn't do anything. You know, the apology, because, like, let's say that you're an alcoholic who has alcoholic rages, And you have the alcoholic rages, and then you turn her, you beat your wife up. And then you go over to her and you say, gee, honey, I'm sorry, you know, it wasn't my fault. It was the guy who drank. What's the wife supposed to do? I forgive you because it wasn't you?
Yeah, it's sort of like trying to disconnect from this person. I mean, you know, an apology and remorse is supposed to be psychologically linked with some behavior that you've just done that we call ego dystonic, meaning it doesn't fit with our sense of who we are. So an apology is supposed to be linked with a recognition and a follow-through that behavior, which I feel remorse about, will not happen again. As we know with alcoholism, and sadly, which is true with this disorder, if it's not treated, people know these apologies don't really stick because, you know, sooner or later, the person, despite the heartfelt apology, has an explosive, rageful attack again. So the apologies mean nothing, especially after they've taken a few times. Just like when people apologize about alcoholic behavior, often people, they say, well, what does this mean, unless you stop drinking and go to AA?
But they do mean something, Kent. To the person who is the addict, or the criminal or the person who does the crime, it does mean something, because when they apologize, they truly feel it. It just doesn't change the behavior. It does mean something, because I've seen people feel supplicant in their confession to their mates. They feel terrible. If they could get a hairbrush and you know, hit themselves over the head with it, you know, if they could punish themselves, they would do it. They do feel, you know, like they've done something really wrong. It's not that it means nothing. It just doesn't change the behavior. So how you deal with an apology is different. I think what you're saying when somebody apologizes to you after having an explosive thing is you say to them, I understand you're sorry. And I understand from the bottom of your heart that you regret what you did. But something has to change here. And we must change something now. And a true sign of your making a difference is that we make a commitment to change. And the commitment to change may be that we hire and have an outside observer. And in this case, this is what people do. I guess that's when people go to see you, Kent. Huh?
Yeah, and certainly the people at the Mills Center and therapists who are, you know, very trained at sort of following through with this commitment of not having this rageful or, you know, again, like a temper tantrum. These are people having 2-year-old rage attacks as adults. And yes, just the promise of no longer having an explosive outburst without some kind of follow through, without some kind of, you know, self-help books in terms of anger management or some kind of professional help, often means nothing to people because they've been through it before. They've had the fearful, angry attack. They've had the apology, and then a week goes by, and they're on the other end of a rage attack.
So what are the other reasons why? Are there any chemical reasons why people have this intermittent explosive disorder? Have they found any chemical reasons why?
Well, again, the too low serotonin syndrome that we had talked about the first part of the show, the too little, the Papa Bear perhaps, serotonin syndrome too low, we absolutely know is related to irritability and an increased tendency to get angry easier. And so for some people, yes, some kind of meditation or therapy that raises the serotonin or some outside serotonin coming from Paxil, Prozac, one of those medications, can also at least decrease the tendency for some people to explode.
Is there ever a reason why, would you ever see somebody who is not explosive becoming explosive as a sign of a possible tumor or some other organic brain dysfunction, possibly?
Oh, absolutely.
If it's new, how do you check for that, Ken? When do you, as a psychiatrist, go from the psychological, which is a psychiatric, which is considering normal brain function, to what may be considered to be truly organic damage like tumors? What would be your diagnostic separation? How would you look? Would you
Well, again, I think if it's a new behavior in somebody, you would want to think about those kinds of things. And as we talked about before, you talked about steroids, but over-the-counter medications maybe is contributing, some toxic reaction. But certainly...
Well, I'm asking you, what are your diagnostic criteria for the difference between organic brain syndrome and non-organic brain syndrome?
Well, it's a very hard differential. I think sometimes people who have more physical symptoms would often go along with something like a steroid-producing tumor or too much thyroid. Those would be two things that would come to mind that you would expect some kind of other symptoms other than a rage attack. For example, increased perspiration, increase in the pulse rate, perhaps thinning of hair, perhaps a feeling of malaise throughout their body. So there would be a little bit of more physical symptoms that would just go along with the psychological symptom of this explosive anger that would suggest maybe there needs to be a medical workup, because you don't want to miss a medical diagnosis masquerading as something psychological.
So when you when you see somebody and they talk to you about what goes on for them, and you're a psychiatrist, but you also have training as a physician, you are a physician. So if people see you and they say to you, you know, I feel I'm dizzy and I'm depressed and I feel lonely, and they give you psychological syndromes, and then they say to you, and I also can't sleep at night, You're still in the psychological. At one point, they cross over. And when they cross over, is it when you start hearing the physical symptoms and the stuff that you connect in your mind to organic? I mean, is it just sweating?
Well, I think it's a feel. I was just reading the book Blink. I mean, I must say that there's a little bit of an intuition, a spidey sense that you get as somebody been doing it as long as I have, to sort of get a feel that some of the symptoms don't fall as neatly into the well-known psychological clusters. Clearly, some kind of other medical problems that are going along with it is also something that tips off somebody like myself, because again, you got to understand the very complex world where I believe, at least a psychiatrist, that many people with stomach aches, dizziness, who are seeing medical doctors, that these are really psychiatric, psychological issues, anxiety, depression, masquerading as medical. And conversely, there's a fair amount of people seeing therapists and psychiatrists, but they have a thyroid problem or a cortisol problem. They're having a medical problem that is masquerading as a psychiatric. And clearly, the question you asked about, well, what tips us off? Again, usually some kind of other physical problem that doesn't necessarily go along with a pure psychological spectrum makes us think about a medical.
Yeah, and one of the big questions we ask as diagnosticians is, when did this start? Mm-hmm. If it's a recent onset, that's a big deal to us. If it's recent onset with no cause, you know, and no attributable cause, that has meaning to us. Mm-hmm. You know, when did you start feeling this way? You know, I suddenly got, everything was happy. I've never been depressed a day of my life. And then suddenly 2 weeks ago, nothing happened. I got depressed. Of course, we say nothing happened. And then as you pursue it a little further and you ask him, you sure nothing happened? Well, you know, my dog died and my boyfriend left me and I got fired, but nothing happened. Right. You know, and then we might find there might be more to it. But a lot of people consider things not important, but it could be that actually nothing did happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that my general feeling is almost anybody over 50, by the way, I usually get them to see a doctor and get a routine physical as well as blood work, because, you know, that's a rare time to have a new, not zero, but a rare time. But I would say to everyone out there that you all should get a thyroid checked if you're on antidepressants, if you have rage, if you have anxiety. And for many people, they say, well, I went to a doctor and all my lab work was normal. You got to understand your regular doctors don't check for thyroid. And studies would show about 1 out of 10 people treated for anxiety and depression, their thyroid's a little low. And you would never know unless somebody thought to check the thyroid level. So that's a key one that I would say everyone should have.
Well, you see, we learn. And there's so much to learn. And there's so much more to learn, and we're lucky because we are here Dr. Kent Robinshaw, I want to thank you very much for being with us once again.
My pleasure.
And bringing us good stuff. And Sonny Rollins last week. Eh? Oh, isn't that something?
That was very sunny.
Wasn't that sunny? That was your doing.
It was great.
We got more coming up. We have Sonny Fortune coming up soon.
We have Sonny Fortune coming up next month.
Next month. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you, Kent. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Remember, tomorrow, tune in. We'll be talking about the thermal wars, and Thursday at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Join us for the party. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Let's see how we're going to leave you. If you want to get a copy of today's program or you want to hear it again, you can go to thepositivemind.com or send me an email, Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at brainlink.com, brainlink.com. Here's a little yiddy yiddy boom. También, si no vacilo, se come también que para gozar. Iriribum, iriribum.